My name is John Bost, and I'm trying to remember the last time I was here. It might have been February. It's been a while. And after more than 25 years of being a full-time pastor, I took a leap of faith and joined the staff of Open Heart Kitchen, based in the Livermore, Pleasanton, Dublin area, as their executive director back in January of last year. One of the most important aspects of my time and my work at Open Heart Kitchen is walking alongside people who are navigating change in their lives. I'm charged with helping guide them and steward them on these large and small-scale changes in their life, and to do this on a daily basis, but also to do this this kind of change thinking at a systems and strategy level too for our organization as a whole. I get to determine when to turn up the temperature at Open Heart Kitchen so that we guard against becoming complacent in this work, because our human tendency seems to be that we stake out claims of relative comfort. And then I also get to determine when to turn the temperature down, because no person and no organization can endure high levels of speed and intensity indefinitely. And so ultimately, both of these movements are captured in this term that we use called theory of change, which simply put is the sum total of all the strategies and actions and conditions and resources that, when combined together, facilitate change and achieve the outcomes we hope for. So two of the things that have struck me early on in my time at Open Heart Kitchen is, one, the rate that some groups of people expect other groups of people to change without also realizing their need for change too, and two, the number of people who don't think they need to change are oftentimes the people I think would most benefit from change, whether that's a change of heart or a change of mind or a change of understanding. Since I have the privilege of walking alongside folks who are often navigating some of the most difficult experiences of their lives, like not knowing where their next meal is coming from, or if they will have a place to lay their head, or if their abuser will finally track them down, or these conversations of change come up often. Each person I work with is faced with an incredible amount of change that they must navigate in order to take the next step forward into a future that is hopefully better and safer and healthier for themselves and their families. And at the heart of each of these change conversations are things like waiting and expectation, longing and hope, despair and disappointment, possibility and promise, and yes, at times, a lot of pain. I think one of the reasons I'm drawn to this work is because my favorite liturgical season has always been the season of Advent. I know we're about a month and a half away from Advent, but I've always been captivated by this liminal space that exists between the dreaming and the coming true for each of us. That in-between space, as it were, has always been the space that feels the most authentically human to me, because it's a space not ignorant of or disconnected from the past, what has come before, nor is it unable to look ahead to the future, to envision a life and a world, a relationship as it could or perhaps even should be. And so the folks that I work with and walk alongside of, they don't claim to be Advent people, but that's exactly who they are. The problem that many of these individuals face is that they feel kind of stuck and what I call the crawl space of their lives. You know this space in your home. Does anyone have a crawl space at your home? It's that space where if it's you have inside access, you have to pop a panel somewhere on the floor, right? Maybe in a closet, or if you have outside access, there's a lock and a panel that you have to lift up. But no matter how you get into that crawl space to your home, it's often dank and dark. Now, technically, in the crawl space of our homes, we have the ability to move around in just about any direction that we like, but there are dangers lurking at every turn. Spiders. I do not like spiders. Uneven ground. And if startled and you pop your head up too quickly, you will quickly learn that the board beneath the floor does not respect your headspace and it does not move. And so, like a crawl space, the people that I serve technically have all the same opportunities of those around them, In some respects, at least on the surface, even the rules those living in the crawl space of their lives play by are the same rules that an employed, fed, sheltered, drug-free, relatively mentally sane person play by. But these same folks living in the crawl space of their lives can never, ever quite fully stand up straight. They always are bent over and bowed. And so what is a floor for most of us oftentimes feels like a ceiling for them. And to break through this ceiling feels virtually impossible for many of them. And so it's not surprising that they and many others in our society feel stuck in the crawl space of their lives. Everyone tells them that they just need to work harder to get unstuck, to get out of the crawl space, but no matter what they do, no matter how many boxes they check, no matter how many hoops they jump through, they feel like they spend the majority of their time stuck in the changing room of their life. I want to tell you a story that comes from a colleague of mine. His name is Pastor Mike Breen, and he recalls a story of when he and his family headed to a brand new health club that had this feature that everyone was talking about. When Mike and his family visited the health club for the first time, his daughters quickly ran over to this new club feature called the sun shower. And they think it's the best thing that's ever happened to them after they go through the sun shower experience. And so they go back to their dad and they insist that he go through the sun shower experience too. And he thinks to himself, I don't even know what a sun shower is. Do I even want to know what the sun shower experience is? And they point over in the corner. There's a white tube over by the pool. You stand up in it and you get a tan, but you also get totally rejuvenated and refreshed. This is the point of the sun shower sunroom experience. It's like standing on the beach of South Carolina, they tell their dad. Well, their dad loves the beaches of South Carolina, so how can he resist? What does it take? He asks. It's just $5 for 3 minutes, and you'll be totally rejuvenated and totally refreshed. Do it, Dad. So he rummages through his pocket for a $5 bill, walks over to the sun shower. The door opens to a room essentially the size of a small closet. Nothing looks too dangerous, so he steps in and closes the door behind him, still not certain what's going on. He makes sure to read the instructions posted on the wall. He follows them to a T. He puts on the pair of goggles. He shuts his eyes tightly, and he waits. And nothing happens. Oh, of course, I have to put the $5 in the machine. He opens his eyes, takes off the goggles, puts the $5 bill in the slot, pulls the goggles back, puts the goggles back on, and waits. Still nothing happens. Well, he heard a slight whirring sound and a few clicking sounds, but he feels nothing. This in no way comes anywhere close to resembling the beaches of South Carolina, he thinks to himself. So when the 3 minutes are up, the whirring stops, and he steps out. His daughters are there, anxiously waiting to hear about his experience. Well, what did you think, Dad? They're so excited. Clearly, they thought the sun shower was the best thing at the club. And he's thinking to himself, how can I possibly let them down? But I just want to be honest with them. And he says, well, I mean, I guess I just don't get it. I mean, it was okay, but probably something you young folks would enjoy much better than me. His daughters, Elizabeth and Rebecca, are profoundly disappointed. They had wanted so badly for their father to share in the sun shower experience, and he hadn't. And frankly, he thinks the whole thing is rather strange, but he doesn't say much more about it. Well, the next week, he's back at the club. Rebecca and Elizabeth come up with renewed fervor. Dad, they said, we think the problem is this. You need not try it for 3 minutes. You need to try it for 6 minutes. Maybe 3 minutes wasn't enough for you to start feeling all the full effects, so give it 6 minutes this time, okay? So he starts to tell him how silly he thinks the whole thing is, but they are giving him those looks, you know, the ones the looks no father can say no to his daughters. And so he steps back into the white tube. He steps inside the room, pulls the door closed behind him, reads the instructions, puts on the goggles, squeezes his eyes shut, feels nothing. Nothing's happening. Oh, right, the money. Now it's up to $10 for 6 minutes, takes his goggles off, puts the money in, closes his eyes again, and waits. 6 minutes is a long time to wait when you're standing in an enclosed booth with your eyes shut, listening to the whirring and clicking noises around you. When it's over, he takes off his goggles, hangs them back on the hook on the wall and leaves. Elizabeth and Rebecca are anxiously waiting for him. How was it this time, Dad, doing it 6 minutes this time? Did you feel the effects this time? And he looks at his daughter's expectant faces. I'm so sorry. I don't know what to say. I just don't think this is for me. And they think he's a total dork. This is just something for you and your friends to enjoy, I said to them. It's not your fault. Maybe I'm just too old to get the full benefits of the experience. And one thing I must say, he says for his children, they don't give up easily. The next week, they're ready again. Dad, this time try it for 9 minutes. You'll really love it if you just give it enough time. 9 minutes should do it for you. Come on, Dad. Please, 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 just do it 9 minutes. So he looks over at his wife for support, but she just gives him that, you got yourself into this, now get yourself out of it look. So he goes off for the third time to the sun shower, steps into the tube, pulls the door shut, reads the instructions clear through the third time. Yep, just what he suspects. They've not changed a word since last week. He puts on the goggles, closes his eyes, sigh, forgets the money. Now he's up to $15 for 9 minutes, and I think he's up to $30 in total investment. Goggles off, money in, goggles on, eyes closed. And let me tell you, if 6 minutes is a long time, then 9 minutes just feels punishing at this point. So he takes a chance, he opens his eyes, only to find that he could see through the goggles. And so he looks around, and he wonders if he'd get more of a tan if he just stands closer to the mirror that he now sees. And so he opens his eyes a little wider. He sees some things that look like coat hooks on the wall. I thought that maybe they were there to reflect the rays, and so standing still for 15 minutes was not much more interesting than keeping his eyes closed for 9 minutes. So he turns around, and there he sees a doorknob. What's this? He turns the knob, and the door opens to a room filled with the most refreshing light rays and replicated ocean breeze one could ever imagine. He'd never seen or felt anything like it before in his life. And he realizes that for 3 weeks, he had been standing in the changing room. Think of the two biggest celebrations in our church every year, Christmas and Easter, possibly Pentecost tied somewhere with the two in there. Christmas reminds us that God is with us. Easter reminds us that God is for us. Pentecost reminds us that God is in us. And although there's a different quality to each of these celebrations, the one thing these three giant festival days have in common is that each of them has a kind of changing room period, right? About 4 weeks worth leading up to Christmas that we call Advent, roughly 40 days, 40 nights for Lent, 50 days for Pentecost. The changing room for our ancestors in the faith wasn't a darkened space with hooks for robes and goggles. The changing room of faith has always been the wilderness, the desert. It appeared that before change ever happens in the centers of respectability in our culture, it always starts somewhere on the margins. Just out of sight for those who don't want to look and for those who wield power and influence. People, we're told, went out to the desert for all sorts of reasons, in this case from Matthew's gospel, to see what John the Baptist was up to. Some people went out of curiosity in the same way that some people slow down to stare when they come upon a traffic accident. Others went out to see if John really posed a serious threat to their established way of life. And then there were plenty of people who went out to the desert because they had nowhere else to go. And they had heard that John could help them find their way. People had either hit rock bottom or had hit a wall, and the promise, just the hint and whisper of a promise of a new beginning, was enough to send them to the margins in hope of escaping their present circumstance. And I've always found it interesting that the gospel writers, every year, require us to go first through John the Baptist before we are ever allowed into the sun shower room where Jesus awaits us. I mean, it's hard to imagine a more stark contrast between God's representatives than John and Jesus. He's kind of like the pit bull of the New Testament, the watchdog, if you will. And it's almost like God has placed John in the narrative of Jesus' life just to make sure that people are up for the challenge. Because if you cannot buy what John is selling, you certainly aren't going to be able to buy what Jesus has to offer. So at first blush, I think we probably do a discredit to John. We think he's all judgment and Jesus is all grace and that they're almost like night and day. But if you've ever been judged before, then you know how precious grace really can be and how those things can be so closely aligned, judgment on the one side and grace on the other. A number of years ago, just shy of Christmas, on an empty lot on the outskirts of downtown Livermore, a group of churches and community organizations got together to put on an event called the Living Bethlehem Experience. It was an attempt to recreate Bethlehem during the time of Jesus. A number of members at my church at the time said it would be a bad look for me if I didn't go, but that's just not really my thing. But I took their advice, loaded my family up in the car, and off we went to the Living Bethlehem Experience. Anyone go to the Living Bethlehem Experience? Good. I can say what I want to about it today. They were all the usual suspects of the Christmas Epiphany story. Mary, Joseph, baby Jesus, wise men, shepherds, angels, barnyard animals, but something was missing. Do you know who wasn't there at the Living Bethlehem Experience? John the Baptist. Apparently, rumor has it, he didn't make the cut. His audition was horrible. But I would have loved to have had the opportunity to just slip in somewhere, show up, unannounced, to play the role of John the Baptist. I would have positioned myself somewhere by the front gate where people were buying tickets to enter into the Living Bethlehem Experience. I would have been like one of those waiters at a restaurant where you pay people to yell at you and dump food on your table, then tell you to go refill your own drink and basically get your life together. How much fun would that have been to play John the Baptist? Imagine the scene. People have come from all over the East Bay and beyond to be ushered back into the ancient Bethlehem experience. They've come to see the Christ child be born. They've come to drink hot chocolate while watching the Christ child be born, just like it was in ancient times. And when they're done, they can walk across the street and they can even buy a Christmas tree and get all this done in the course of a couple hours. And so after all of their patient waiting in the cold, they're now next in line to be led into the city by Roman soldiers. I don't know where they show up, but they're there when all of a sudden and out of nowhere, a guy who looks like Gandalf leaps in front of them and shouts at the top of his voice, "You bunch of snakes!" From Livermore, Pleasanton, Dublin, San Ramon, Danville, who told you to try to escape the hellfire? His axe is in his hand. He will cut you to the root. He's going to separate the good seed from the trash, and the trash he'll cast into the fire. I'm not worthy to untie his shoelaces. You better get washed up. Strip off those fine clothes and come down here in this muddy water and get baptized. You've been warned. And it would be awesome. Your kids would be crying. You'd be angry at your kids crying. You might even be a little scared. You're thumbing up on your cell phone looking for the website for corporate's number, because that's what people in the Bay Area do. They call corporate. How dare anyone tell you that your life is anything less than perfect? Doesn't this scrappy character standing in your personal bubble space know how much money you make in a year? Does he know the kind of car you drive? Does he have any idea what kind of stock options you have lined up? Just ask anyone else who knows about important stuff and important people, and they'll tell you that a message of repentance is wasted on you because you're perfect. This rough and tough camel hair wearing guy would be better off spewing his bag of bad breath on the moochers hanging down at the Vineyard Resource Center in Livermore, eating, sleeping, showering, and washing their family's clothing, those horrible things that only homeless people do. Total losers. Now, if there was ever anyone in need of a reconstruction and repentance project, it would be the homeless people down there. And so you leave unfulfilled, unsatisfied, having stood in line for an hour in the cold, and you didn't even get to sing, "O Holy Night." And so just to make sure I wasn't putting words into John the Baptist's mouth in my dream reenactment role at the 21st century Bethlehem highly stylized village experience, I went back and read and reread the story to see exactly how John, many years ago, put together what I can only imagine was a kind of ancient triage system. Now, the medical field today calls an in-the-field triage system START, which is short for Simple Triage and Rapid Treatment. And so I try to imagine John the Baptist working out his own kind of START, Simple Triage and Rapid Treatment, but let's say John might have called it the Sinner's Triage and Rapid Transformation. So as many of you already know, John was well ahead of his time, especially in his decision to do only what I can imagine was a kind of color-coding system for the victims of sin, where he ranked the worst kind of sin to the not-so-bad when compared to those other kind of sins. Now, for those sinners who had no chance at all of getting clean in the water by John in the Jordan, no matter how much soap and water John used, he would tag them with a gray tag. They were as good as dead. They were hopeless. For sinners who had done something really bad and simply could not find a way to forgive themselves, and who were on the verge of ending it all, he tagged them with a red tag. This meant they had a relative chance of survival, but not unless someone intervened immediately to help arrest their current trajectory. If that didn't happen, they simply would not make it. And then there were the yellow tags, and those went to the sinners who were actually doing pretty well managing their sin. They had enough money, they could hire a sin management consultant. And when they came down to the river, they clearly had some bumps and bruises from the times their sin had gotten out of hand, but honestly, they were not in any real immediate danger. Being tagged yellow meant that they had things, for the most part, under control. Perhaps a few skeletons in the closet that they didn't want anyone to find out about, but nothing a little wet wipe wouldn't take care of. And John could have them in and out home in no time. And finally, some of the people that came to the river where John was baptizing folks, well, they got green tags, and oh my God, the green tags, well, they're just to die for. I mean, well, not really. Those are the gray tags, but you know what I mean. I mean, I should say that the green tags were the most coveted tags of all, because when you got a green tag, you were considered to be nothing more than the walking wounded. And it meant that you're still going to need to get some soap and water at some point in time, maybe not all that frequently, but only after the more serious sinners have been soaped and watered first. And let's be honest, everyone knows how tiny your sins are when compared to so-and-so over there. Not naming any names today, Kyle and Karen. You might as well go down to the river, soak up the sun, and have a picnic on the banks of the Jordan River. It's going to be a long, long time before it's your turn to go down in the water to get soaped and cleaned. You're a green tagger, after all. People poured out of Jerusalem, Judea, and the Jordanian countryside to hear and see John in action. There at the Jordan River, those who came to confess their sins were baptized into a changed life. That's what the gospel tells us. And some people that day came up out of the water and said it was as if they were a new creation. It was as if coming up out of the water was like coming face to face with the first day of the rest of their life, and they were singing, "Morning has broken like the first morning, blackbird has spoken like the first bird," and they were morning and blackbird. And some people that day came up out of the water, and they felt like they had been born again, like they were babies, fresh and clean and not guilty of anything, with the rest of their lives ahead of them, full of possibility and potential without limitation or obstacle. It was like someone loved them so deeply and so much, as though they were almost at the hospital pressing their face against the nursery window to say, there, that child is mine. And although you had no hair, you were perfect. No worry, no stain, no blemish, no marks against you, no mistakes. You were brand new, the rest of your life still ahead of you. And some people that day came up out of the water and said it felt like they had turned over a new leaf. And others said it felt like they had turned a page in the book of their life. It was like they were trying to figure out this cold, hard, unforgiving calculus of the world. when they had made a terrible mistake, and then they went to try and erase that mistake, but they only made things worse by doing so. And then one last pass of the eraser, and they tore a hole in the page. They wanted to get it right, but all they did was mess things up. But then when they came up out of the water, it was as if the teacher said everything was going to be okay and handed them a new piece of paper and said, try again. But then he said he wasn't the teacher, he was just the teacher's assistant, and that the teacher, the real teacher, would be coming soon. If I'm being completely honest with you this morning, I don't have the slightest clue when, how, or where God will show up in your life, but I'm convinced that it has something to do with dreaming dreams that you would never dream on your own, and singing songs made from notes you've yet to hear, and receiving new storylines that you could not have written for your life even if you tried. And so whatever you take away from you this morning through our time together, please remember this above all else. Whether you find yourself in the changing room of your life, and perhaps it's even a changing room you did not choose for yourself and may therefore want to exit quickly, I believe that all that any of us ever really want to know is this: whatever we go through, can we come out of it stronger and more resilient than when we went in? And two, if we must struggle and stumble in the dark alone, is there no one else to walk this journey with us? That's really the crux of every hard thing in our life. Can we come out of it stronger and more resilient? And can we realize that we were never alone? Our culture often tells us that we are alone, and that we can only trust ourselves, and that we should never, ever, ever unnecessarily burden others with our problems and our pain. But I think this message has made us sick. And it's made us sick with loneliness, and it's made us sick with isolation. And I think the only antidote is community. That people need people. And that all the best kind of community is located at the intersection where we find healing and hope. And so maybe you're at a point in your life where it's time to step into the light of the sun shower. Maybe you're at a place where you need to tell others your story. Maybe you're at a place where you need to be more of a story receiver and less of a storyteller. And of course, the beauty and terror of all of this adventure is that no one can tell you how to do it. No one can tell you how to do this work. You get to decide. That's the beauty and terror of it. And so never let anyone take that away from you. It's what makes you and I most human. Amen.